In the studio, I have two guests to talk about a program for tonight, which will be held music starting at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. It's part of the Bullock Performance Institute series. With me are flutist Aaron Lesser. Hello.
Good morning.
And composer Jeff Harriet. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you could take a little time out of the preparation for this concert to talk about the work and invite listeners to come join you for it. Let's start with you, Jeff. Where have you traveled from to be here today?
I've come from Wisconsin. I teach at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater, where I've been teaching composition and electronic music for almost 15 years now.
Do you know Christopher Biggs, the composer?
I do know Christopher,
here,
yes.
At Western.
I've met him many times over the years, so yes, I do know Chris.
Would you say you come from a community of composers interested in new music?
Certainly. I'm interested in new things, inspired by new sounds. For me, going to a concert, a lot of times I'm wondering how I'm going to be surprised. Not that I want to be hit over the head all the time, but I love going and hearing things I haven't heard before, sounds I haven't experienced, and I take those away and try to find something to do similar the next time.
Did you grow up with a kind of traditional, classical, formal training?
I did. I grew up playing piano. My mom brought a garage sale piano home, I think, when I was 5, and started giving me lessons, and then, you know, took other lessons with other people and grew up playing traditional piano stuff. It wasn't until I got older that I realized I could do other things besides just play Mozart or whatever.
Yeah.
It just didn't occur to me. Even though I was listening to other music on the radio, I just didn't connect to those worlds. I didn't connect my classical music world playing as a kid and the things that I was hearing. Actually, it was when I was in high school. I remember I was in a music theory class, and the teacher played the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. And I was like, oh, wait, you can do that? What? And then it sort of changed my idea of what music could be after that.
What kind of ensembles have you typically written for? I realize that could be
sure.
Sky's the limit, but.
Well, I've written a lot of pieces in the last 10 years for what I would say, like instrument and electronics. So soloist with electronics or duo with electronics or usually small chamber groups with electronics. Almost everything I've written has had some electronic component in the last 15 years, but I wouldn't say that it's about the electronics. I want it to be about the performers, whatever the instruments are. But I'm interested in electronics that kind of take the sound of an instrument and then change it slightly or slightly expand the timbre. That's what happens a bit in the piece tonight. There's a section that Aaron plays in the third section of the piece where she's just playing this melody along. It's kind of a florid, you know, melody. Kind of goes up and down, and it's sort of pretty. And then there's electronics that are tracking as she's playing and just slightly making it sort of bubbly, is I guess the way to describe it. It feels like there's little bubbles sort of floating around her pitches. And that's all it does, that kind of thing.
This is one piece that we'll be hearing tonight, performed at 7:30 p.m. And there is a pre-concert discussion at 7 p.m. I imagine you'll be talking to the audience then, too, Dr. White and possibly Aaron, or maybe you'll be backstage still warming up.
We might have to see how we feel at that point.
Yeah. This does happen to be a collaboration with students at Western Michigan University. Would you describe how that's set up?
Sure. The premise when I wrote the piece, it was I wanted something that could be played not just by the performers, but by wherever they went, sort of play with people at the place that they went. And I actually considered all sorts of different formats of maybe even last-minute additions of other people. But I settled on the idea of this duo, which is Aaron and Greg for flute and percussion. And their part is much more virtuosic and complicated, and they have to work hard to put their own parts together ahead of time. And then the quartet, there's a percussion quartet, and they can sort of practice some of the sections by themselves completely because they're playing entirely by themselves. And then they have other sections where they're playing and supporting the duo with things that are sort of easy to put together, I guess. They're sort of time-based. If they can sort of follow the score, then they can fill in their parts. So it was intended to be put together in a short stay. And that was also an opportunity for then for Greg and Aaron to interact with the students and give them some coaching. And it's sort of a different experience for the students to come in and actually play with the guest artists in a real way. I mean, that usually if you bring in guests, you just don't have time to do that. And this piece was designed to have that time.
The piece is called The Stone Tapestry. And here I'd like to ask Aaron the story, to tell us the story of how it was commissioned and first performed.
Well, Greg and I have been working together since 2001. And in about 2007 or 8, I think, we worked with a consortium of composers on an album's worth of music. And at that point, we met Jeff Harriet. He was one of six composers that wrote for the duo. And we had a great experience working with Jeff. We traveled around the country working with these six different composers and performing at their various institutions. And Jeff wrote a lovely piece for flute, percussion, and electronics. And during the course of that project, we started saying, wouldn't it be great to do another project together, maybe something a little bigger? And I honestly can't remember if it was Jeff's idea or if it was just a conversation that might have sparked the idea of collaborating with student groups.
I think I was trying to think of how to make large-scale things happen, because I wanted it to not just be a duo, but I wanted it to be a large experience. So I was thinking, how do I make a giant experience happen, but for this duo? And so then I was thinking, well, if I want additional players, then it needs to be portable in this. So it was really kind of a practical matter, how to make it work with the duo, but then still make a larger experience so that we have six players on stage.
But I know as performers, we've also discussed many times how we want to have meaningful interactions with students when we go places and visit. It can sometimes be hard to like pop in for the day and leave and not really know what impact you've had. And this, you know, maybe it's a small group of students, just four, but we really get to work with them and model some rehearsal techniques and get into the music. And hopefully that leaves a more lasting imprint.
I think that is a really exciting component of this piece and a great reason why it should be toured a lot.
Sounds good.
Aaron, what's it like to be a flutist in a flute and percussion duo?
Well, sometimes I feel a little guilty as I watch him unpack all of his instruments. I have learned to put together a marimba and a vibraphone. I'm pretty adept at that at this point. And in this piece, actually, I'm playing five different flutes. So for once, four different flutes. Didn't use the piccolo.
I did not use it. You told me not to use the piccolo, so I didn't use the piccolo.
But I do have a lot of gear of my own, so I fit in a little better.
Do you ever have to turn around and say, look, I'm running out of breath. Can you hurry it up a little?
It's a bit of a challenge in a good way. It forces you to come up with ways to play a little louder or to sustain your breath a little differently and to match pitch with ringing gongs that you can't quite tell what that pitch is. So it's really fascinating. I always love it. I've always loved contemporary music myself, so I like the challenge.
Actually, you do that really, really well in this first movement of The Stone Tapestry, which was this recorded for a CD, an album release. Mm-hmm. Is it available?
Yeah, it's coming. I think it's coming out in like 2 weeks. Oh, it'll be available tonight also, but it is just coming out now.
Yeah. We received our physical copies just this past week.
Yes.
Would you set up this opening movement?
Sure.
Just the first few minutes of it.
Sure. So the first chunk is called Clouds of Stone, and this is for the whole ensemble. And actually, I was telling them on the walk over, I wrote the little chunk of this here at this school, I think a few years ago. I was here for something else with Chris, and I started working on what became the vibraphone part. And there's all these pipes that are happening sort of spatially. These ringing pipes. And I was just kind of thinking, I mean, it's sort of chime-like, but it's not really intended to be like hearing wind chimes exactly. But there is that effect because of the pipes. And then it goes into this vibraphone part, and then eventually Aaron comes around. I was trying to think of sort of swimming, even though it says clouds of stone. I was imagining swimming a lot when I was working on it.
Any other meaning that stone tapestry brings for you? Like that you, is there a narrative here?
There is. I have a narrative in, like, in my head. There's a narrative of these of this idea of different myths, and that you're sort of moving through a mythological space. And I mean, in this, on the CD cover, for example, I'm carrying giant stones around, and there are these sticks that we placed up in the, and built some contraption out of sticks and rope in on a mountaintop, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so what's going on there isn't really clear, but yeah, I was sort of imagining other mythologies or something like that.
Let's hear a few minutes of the opening movement of this, this big work, the Stone Tapestry, it's called. Performances tonight at 7:30 p.m. Details at wmish.edu/music/events. We're hearing music from a piece called The Stone Tapestry, entering into a completely unfamiliar sound world. If you didn't hear the beginning of this interview, my guests are flutist Ellen Lesser and the composer of the piece, Jeff Harriet. Aaron and percussionist Greg Beyer are performing this work tonight at 7:30 p.m., The Stone Tapestry. This is from Section 1, Clouds of Stone. I think we've heard some of the building blocks of the piece here. What I'm curious about is how many people are actually involved playing right. I can't tell.
So right when we were ending in that first, in the first movement, there's six performers. There's the percussion and flute duo, and Greg is playing vibes in that section, vibraphone, and Aaron's playing regular flute at the end. And then there are four percussionists playing pipes, little chunks of copper pipe that are sitting on the table in front of them, and they each are have a set of five.
Have they been tuned in any way?
They're not tuned.
Okay.
They're sort of unspecified. We went out and found resonant ones that sit on little pieces of like weather stripping so that they can ring longer. And they generally try to sit them at the nodal points so they don't get muted. And then eventually there were some wine glasses, and there's electronics too. So the electronics sort of, that's one of the fun things I like about using electronics is you don't know necessarily how many players are there. You can extend from one person to the equivalent of 50 or whatever. The electronics that come in at the end are just sort of used to enhance the vibraphone and make it seem a little bit more other. It's actually supposed to be kind of like turning the motor on the vibes, but with a different sort of motor, if that makes sense.
I'm not following very well.
The motor spins over the top of the pipe. So that it gives it that vibrato, sort of wah, 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 wah,
yeah,
wah
okay,
sound.
Yeah, I get that.
And so the idea with electronics is I'm trying to make it sort of go blah, 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 sort of more randomized motor.
So it that's amplifies the sound.
Kind of. It re-amplifies the sound.
Just a little.
Yep, that's the idea.
Is that electronics or is it mechanics?
Well, the motor is mechanics. The electronics is that I'm doing. It's sort of like trying to imitate a weird motor.
Ah, okay. So
That's what I was attempting to do.
The electronics are quite subtle throughout the piece. And Jeff does this very well in most of his music, I would say. It's like you just hear this sort of cloud of sound hovering over the ensemble, and you almost don't know it's there until the performer stopped, and then you sort of notice what's in the room. And it's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. A curious soundscape that is hard to identify. That's one of my favorite things about listening to this piece is...
Yeah, and all these ringing metals blend in so well. It's really hard to tell where the sounds are coming from. Even when you're in the room watching, you can see players striking gongs or rubbing wine glasses, but it's hard to quite pinpoint where the sounds are coming from.
It sounds like it does demand a careful setup. How long does it take to do that?
It took about an hour last night to set everything up in the right position, although we still had to move around. I think we were probably, in our rehearsal last night, we weren't making noise for about an hour and a half, other than the noise of moving chairs and setting up wine glasses and filling them up with the right amount of water to get the right pitches.
So those are tuned.
They are tuned.
They are.
The wine glasses are tuned, yeah. I was going to say, I tell my composition students, I often think of music composition like magic, like a magic trick in the sense that you're focusing on one thing and then you can pull something out of the ear because they're looking over, you know, your left hand, so you can use your right hand to pull something out of your ear. And I think in terms of my use of electronics, I'm thinking that way, where you're paying attention to something and something else happens and you aren't sure where it came from.
Yeah.
That sort of is what I'm trying to think of with electronics.
Prestidigitation.
Presto. Yes.
Wonderful. Again, it's Due East, the name of the group, enhanced by a student ensemble at Western Michigan University, performing The Stone Tapestry by Jeff Harriet. We've heard a section from the opening movement, but it does go in many different directions from there, because we have about 7 minutes left in the hour. What are some of the directions it does go?
Well, the it's a sort of a ritualistic performance. And what I mean by that is that they're very deliberate in their motion. And so essentially, we talked earlier that there isn't really a story, but there is some ritual in the way the performers move that kind of hints at story. The percussionists come out and grab some stones in the second section, and then they're scraping their stones on pieces of wood at the front of the stage in another section. And in that section, there's a more florid, to say like a bigger melody in the flute and the vibraphone. There's some sections that are very sort of repetitive, faster and slower. That happens a few different times. There's some more pipes. There's the contrabass flute and bass flute section is sort of a solo. That's kind of the farthest reaches of distant slowness.
This may be a very rare opportunity to actually see a bass flute.
It's a giant contrabass flute.
I actually have a contrabass flute.
I don't understand. how can that exist?
So if you can imagine, a flute is a start. The lowest note is essentially a middle C on a piano keyboard. That's a note a lot of people are familiar with. A bass flute sounds a whole octave below that. So it sounds, you know, like a male voice, or it's got that deeper quality. And then the contrabass is another whole octave below that. Mm-hmm. So it has the same low note as the lowest part of a cello. So it's really down in the depths of the bass clef.
This is an instrument that's pretty unwieldy. You don't carry it in your arms, right?
It has an end pin like a cello, and it stands on the floor. So it's got some support that way. And then it looks like a big number four. It's actually taller than me. And so it reaches above my head and then kind of curves back down so that I can blow into the mouthpiece.
And the mouthpiece is on the horizontal bar of the four.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And it curves up and then back mm-hmm. down to the floor.
And as a flutist, I mean, most people have seen a flute. They know what a flute is. And yet when I walk out carrying a contrabass, I can hear people go, oh my goodness, what is that? And it's kind of a fun reaction to get as a flute player.
Price range for a contrabass flute?
Well, it's a good question. There are beautiful ones made out of solid silver and metals, and those can be up to $25,000. I did not have that kind of money, so I bought one that's made of PVC pipe. It's literally made of plastic and copper kitchen sink pipes. And a man in Amsterdam makes these, and so that one was between $7,000 and $8,000.
It's the player, not the instrument.
There you go.
Well, we'll have to look at final thoughts here.
Sure.
Again, it's the Stone Tapestry. Jeff Harriott is the composer. Let's hear from the composer.
Well, the goal when I wrote this was to have an inviting concert experience, large, and you know that you really have to sort of sit in, let your mind go a little bit. It is a relaxing piece. There's some moments of intensity, but it's very serene also. I was talking yesterday about the fact that I sometimes want to relax myself, and I write music that sort of forces me to sit back. And this piece, I think, does that in a really large form. That's part of the point of it. So,
how about you, Aaron?
As a performer, I love playing this music. I can just kind of sink into the sound and lose track of time. I'm just listening to my sound in the air and how it's mingling. And I think as an audience member, it's not so different from that. We played in Chicago the other night, and after the performance, someone came up and said, I'm in such a great place right now. Thank you so much. And I think it really is just a sort of lovely meditative experience.
I would add that in my short time listening to music from this piece, I definitely lost a sense of continuity of time. Found myself dreaming weird, thinking weird things and strange thoughts. Just it allows you to kind of disconnect. Mm-hmm. But the idea that people have, there's a little bit of connection to human ritual in mm-hmm. this piece, and the incredibly curious assortment of things on stage would make me even more excited to be there in person, which is tonight. The concert begins at 7:30 p.m. There is a pre-concert discussion at 7 p.m. with Dr. Bob White, and you can find out more online at wmich.edu/music/events. Let's listen to a little of the bass flute section from the Stone Tapestry. And thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
Thank you.